open a book and it invites you to fall in.
That was my North Star. I always sailed towards that star.
I began to think, rather than write a whole pedestrian book about 30 years of American history, why not find 3, 4, 5 people from around the country, representative areas?
Welcome to the National Writer Series on Interlochen Public Radio. I'm Doug Stanton. Today, journalist, novelist, and playwright George Packer explains why his best-selling nonfiction doesn't give you all the answers.
I did not want to give you a little tidy what's wrong with America and how to fix it. I wanted to plunge you into the stream of history through these stories and have you find yourself through that.
George Packer's new book, The Unwinding, An Inner History of the New America, won the 2013 National Book Award for Nonfiction. Packer is a staff writer for The New Yorker magazine and has contributed numerous articles on foreign affairs, American politics, and literature to many publications. He spoke with his friend Benjamin Bush, an ex-Marine and author of the memoir Dust to Dust.
Let's talk about how you ventured from Yale into West Africa as a young man in search of what he might find. What drove you to kind of explore that place at a time when the economy was booming and everyone was not going to Africa?
The economy, you're a little younger than I am. The economy was not booming in 1982.
It was going to.
Some people here might remember what was called the Reagan recession. So I graduated at the moment of, you know, until that point, the greatest recession since the Great Depression. We've since outdone ourselves. But why did you join the Marines? I mean, I wanted to see the world. I wanted to do something hard. I wanted to find out who I was. I wanted to be tested. But I was not going to join the Marines for various reasons, mainly because it just the idea never remotely occurred to me.
We didn't get to you in time.
You didn't. I barely knew what the Marines were in 1982. It was that long period from Vietnam to Gulf War I and II when people of my generation didn't look to the military really as a way to find yourself. But I kind of wish I had. Instead, I had my own little hard service overseas. It was in a little village in Togo. And I was there for a year and a half, and it was the loneliest, longest, most perilous experience of my life. It kind of turned me into a writer, I would say. In a way, it turned me into a journalist because I had to learn how to talk to and listen to people who were very different from me. And I found out that I was quite interested in them and good at getting them to talk and to tell me their story and to open up.
And of all things, you were teaching English. That's what you're.
I was. It was the, you know, the rock bottom of Peace Corps uselessness. What do you do when you graduate from Yale with a degree in Renaissance studies? You
become a Renaissance man.
You go teach English to 10-year-olds in Togo. I mean, the cliche is that you learn more than you ever teach, and that was certainly true in my case. But I didn't become a journalist after that, and it's sort of a long, circuitous route to books like The Unwinding. It took a long time for me to figure out what kind of writer I am. I did a lot of other things as a writer in the meantime, but it was that period on my own in Togo that I think I was hanging on by my fingernails, and it was really those conversations with the villagers and all the notes I was taking in my journal that kind of kept me going.
Do you think, even now that you have retrospect, that it's chaos that best focuses you on how to establish an order? Is it the search through uncertainty that drives you to find some kind of narrative strain, something that you can build around, somehow to find a story?
I never think about it in terms of finding order in chaos so much, but I do look for patterns and I listen, and in listening, I begin to pick up recurring words and themes and questions. You start to find out who the people you're listening to are by, you know, paying careful attention to what they keep coming back to, and then you go off and talk to someone else, and you hear that same story from a different angle or a different take on the same theme. And then you begin to realize there is something that's organizing life here that everyone seems to care about. In Togo, what I began to feel was I started out in a position of they're utterly unlike me. They are living so close to nature. The cycles of the seasons, the cycles of life are everything here. No one seems to have an idea about the future. There was no word for the future in the local language.
Really?
Which when I heard that, it rang a bell like, wow, that makes sense. This is all about circularity, not linearity forward. So I kind of had a fixed idea of, well, this is what peasant life in Africa is like. And then over that year and a half, as I listened, I began to realize that wasn't true. They were in this gray area where that was certainly the life they came out of. But they now knew enough about another kind of life, the life of the city, the life of Lagos two countries over, the life of New York or Paris, that they were, it was a neither nor. And they were all, especially the more educated ones, in a state of a kind of crisis where they didn't quite know who they were because education was taking them away from the village, but there was really no place for them to be educated and to live that life in Togo. It was a little dictatorship. It was kind of a junior version of Mobutu Zaire. It was a very unpleasant place to be a Togolese. And yet they were beginning to get ideas. And so in a way, they were more like me than I had imagined. And that was an exciting discovery. So that's sort of the trajectory that the Village of Waiting takes you through.
And just the name itself, the Village of Waiting, we're all waiting for what happens next.
Yeah.
You kind of go into that with a number of your books. The Assassin's Gate, of course, about Iraq. The Unwinding itself is kind of it always comes with a sense of forecast, a worry about the coming weather from where we're standing. And so much of the Assassin's Gate for me was prophetic. Of course, I was there the year before you, and then the year after you, when this book was being written. How is it that you seem so fascinated by what drives people? Is that the essential message you're always seeking when you go into a place you obviously always go into places you don't know, it seems, except for in Blood of Liberals, which was going into your own past. And then
which I didn't really know, actually, as it turned out, until I went into it and then found there, you know, things more disturbing in some ways than Iraq. Yeah, it's dangerous to find your father's papers in a, you know, in an attic that had been untouched for 20 years and to spend a week reading every word of them. Mm. Your father, who you haven't seen, he'd been dead for 20 years when I found those papers. So that was, in some ways, you know, the book I had to write. You know, The Assassin's Gate is about ideas and consequences. And it begins with a set of ideas about the war and the people who were formulating those ideas. And some of them became household names, like Paul Wolfowitz and Donald Rumsfeld. And some of them are not well known. Kanaan Makia, the Iraqi scholar and writer who wrote Republic of Fear. I was talking to people before the war about what ideas were propelling this event, which seemed to be willed. It did not seem like this has to happen, or history is forcing this to happen, or it's just come and found us, we didn't want it. No, this was something people wanted and sought. And in a way, the idea of the war preceded the rationales for the war. First, we were going to have a war, and then we had to find the reasons for having the war. So I wrote about that set of ideas and arguments. And then I went to Iraq and kept going back for 4 or 5 years, although I wrote The Assassin's Gate in the middle of that, to see what life did these ideas have? What reality did they have? And it turned out that as a friend of mine, Dexter Filkins, who wrote a wonderful book about the war, the Forever War, said when I met him in Baghdad, ideas make me nervous. They get people killed. And that happened in Iraq. There was this huge gap between the abstractions and the predictions and the false notions of what Iraq was and what the Arab world was and who America was, and then this encounter between these two countries. And what interested me, and more than interested, what obsessed me when I got there was to see how these two people understood each other. So I wanted to be at the meeting point of Iraqis and Americans. And that was hard to find, mm-hmm. because the Americans, many of them were hidden away behind multiple perimeters of security in the Green Zone. The Iraqis were aware that America was in their country and there's a patrol going by, but they never seemed to talk to Americans or to, there was this huge gap between them. And I found that the point of meeting happened probably at about the level where you were, which is to say, senior NCOs, junior officers, who actually had to go out and figure out why the garbage wasn't getting picked up, or how can we get water to this neighborhood that's never had piped water, or what do we do about the crime problem? In other words, having to act like administrators, and that is where Americans and Iraqis, I think, first had to encounter each other. So I just spent as much time as I could
right, that juncture.
At that point, sitting through those meetings, going out on those patrols, and it was endlessly interesting and dismaying because you could just see, with the best will in the world,
so much mutual frustration.
Goodwill and sorry results. Yeah.
I'm going to read a little piece from Assassin's Gate, and then something that you just wrote in The Unwinding, kind of tying this all together, because of course Iraq is a piece of this period of time that you cover. Rumsfeld's words, which soon became notorious, implied a whole political philosophy. The defense secretary looked upon anarchy and saw the early stages of democracy. In his view, and that of others in the administration, but above all the president, freedom was the absence of constraint. Freedom existed in divinely endowed human nature, not in man-made institutions and laws. Remove a 35-year-old tyranny and democracy will grow in its place, because people everywhere want to be free. There was no contingency for psychological demolition. What had been left out of the planning were the Iraqis themselves. This became very prophetic. And
the quote that sort of precedes that is the famous,
stuff happens,
freedom is untidy. That's what Rumsfeld said when he was asked about the looting in Baghdad right after the invasion. Yeah.
And then just recently about this book, The Unwinding, you say in response to kind of, you know, what do you worry about America now? And you say, you worry that we've lost our nerve, our sense of possibility. It exists in individuals, but it's a private thing. Democracy is very hard, in some ways unnatural. It takes constant effort and learning and recommitment. A lot of people I met while working on The Unwinding no longer think that our democracy has much to offer them. They think the game is rigged and they're not included. It's almost a strange reflection of exactly how Iraq feels now, disenfranchised from its own government process.
In a way, Iraq is part of The Unwinding. But because I'd already written this book, The Assassin's Gate, when I tried to think about how to shape a narrative about 35 years of American institutions starting to fall apart, it seemed like I just couldn't do it. I could not bring the wars into it. It just, there wasn't room. And that's in some ways something missing. There is a sketch of Colin Powell, who I think, whose life story represents sort of the best of American institutions, you know, recognizing this talent out of the South Bronx and lifting him up through the ranks, and, you know, the egalitarian spirit of the military is really evident in the life of Colin Powell. Mm-hmm. What he didn't understand was that that very institution that was his career, he was so devoted to it that he couldn't see that it had been, it was being corrupted. And in 2003, he was used by people who were not committed to it as he was, and he allowed them to use him because he was, above all, a great staff officer. He was not someone who was going to go his own way. So the Iraq story is part of this larger story of post-war institutions that had a sort of social contract at their heart beginning to unravel in the last few decades.
From that same experience, you obviously write a lot of essays for, particularly for The New Yorker. One of those essays, which I read long ago, and the reason I first sent you a message, actually, was you wrote a piece called Betrayed about the Iraqi interpreters and how we'd kind of use them for what they were useful for, which was our only way to communicate with an entire country. And then we essentially abandoned them, left them to their fate, and they were all considered traitors. They'd worked for the wrong side, even though it was in an earnest effort, mostly, to help form a new nation. You then turned that into a play. How did that idea come to you, that this essay about Iraqi interpreters was going to be something which could take place on stage?
Yeah, it doesn't seem completely obvious when you think about it. And I never had that. You know, every writer thinks, oh, maybe Hollywood will call, but the idea of actually, oh, you're going to write a play? That didn't seem to follow. Well, what happened was this came near the end of my period of writing about Iraq.
Right.
It was in 2007. I went back for one last trip specifically to find these people because I'd begun hearing stories about people I knew or people I knew who knew others. A whole world of these interpreters had either gone underground or was trying to flee the country or they were actually getting killed. Because they had the biggest target on them, and they were the most defenseless people in Iraq. They did not have a militia of their own.
Right.
The Iraqi security forces didn't like them, and we were...
Because they'd had a higher status in the conflict, because they were with the Americans even more so.
They were not trusted, and it showed the incredible depth of mistrust. The Iraqis who were there to facilitate the indispensable dialogue between Americans and Iraqis were considered the most dangerous and untrustworthy people in Iraq. And so they were getting killed. They were being chased out of the country, and we were just washing our hands of it. The official bureaucracy, it was of a piece with everything else in that war. At the higher levels, there was a what? Interpreters? Well, they've done a service for us, and we thank them for it. And if they find they can't live in Iraq, then we don't insist that they continue to work for us. That was it. So I went and found them. It was very hard to find them. It was the rock bottom of January 2007. It was a really scary time.
Now you were going around on your own, too. You were going the back streets to find people in their homes, essentially, right?
If they would let me. But by that time, making arrangements was really hard. That had been the way I always worked in Iraq. But by 2007, you had to really go through elaborate preparations like, okay, I'll meet you in the lobby of this hotel, but then we're going to go up to the 11th floor and take a room because I don't want the desk clerk to see us because I don't know who the desk clerk is. No one could trust anyone. So we would go up and I spent like 2 days in a room in the Palestine Hotel talking to a couple of Iraqis. Another guy who was from Najaf said, I'll meet you at the Baghdad airport and we'll get on flight so-and-so to Erbil, Kurdistan. And we'll talk in Kurdistan, but we're not talking anywhere in Iraq, including...
That is elaborate.
Yeah, and it went on and on. And then some people, you know, they were going to meet me, and then something happened in their neighborhood, and they couldn't get to me, because that was the period of the worst stage of the Civil War. So as if I needed any more proof of what kind of danger these guys were in, and women, just having the interviews sort of showed it. So I came home with maybe two dozen stories. And what I did was had each of them take me through the whole experience of the war as they had lived it. I didn't just want what's happening now, because I felt this class of people, English-speaking, young Iraqis, most of them had nothing to do with journalism before or with the military before the invasion. They were doctors, they were engineers, they were students. They all were seizing something by going to work for the Americans. To them, this was hope. We offered hope.
And they were the ones that, in Iraq, who learned the most about us. They kind of got, they figured us out because we're so transparent.
Exactly.
They're on our bases and they can see what we're watching on YouTube and they can go, this is America.
Exactly. And you just feel, yeah, quite naked in front of them. I remember this conversation I overheard between like an army captain and an Iraqi, and he kept saying, "We don't want to run your country. We want you to run your country." And the Iraqi was just kind of nodding like, "You want us to run it. You're going to go home as soon as possible, right?" Yeah, they just saw everything. And so we actually came to rely on them as cultural interpreters. What the hell? And also as security for me, I couldn't cross the street in Baghdad without an interpreter with me to tell me, see that guy sitting over there outside that restaurant? Let's go in the other direction. Mm. I didn't pick up signs like that necessarily. So they were indispensable both to journalists and to our diplomats and soldiers and Marines.
And it was a wonderful piece, but I mean, how did How did you think that that was?
Because I came back from that trip with their voices in my head, with these whole stories of the war. Each one of them gave me, here's where I grew up, and here's what it meant to me when the Americans came, and here were my early contacts, and they were all dramatic, really dramatic. They were like a series of events when they began to realize the Americans don't trust me, even though I'm working for them every day. The Iraqis don't trust me. Not only do they not trust me, they actually might be trying to kill me. I'll go to the Americans with that. The Americans aren't going to help me. And then the sudden, awful conclusion, I'm alone. I have nobody. I have to. And all the details of their identity cards. Yeah, they had to have two or three badges just to get into the green zone. Well, those badges were a death sentence if they got caught by the wrong people. So they would hide them in their shoes or put them under the floor mat in their car. They would erase all their friends' names from their cell phones. They would, if they got a call from their American boss on the street, they would just speak Arabic and hang up. It was very, very dramatic stuff. And I don't know, these voices stuck in my head. I felt, I'm not done with this. And I almost felt like I don't want to be in the way. The 16,000 word New Yorker piece, which is what Betrayed was, well, that was my angry, you know, attempt to make some order out of all the stories I'd heard. But I wanted them, their lives to be unmediated by a journalist. Mm-hmm. And the way to do that, I thought, was to let them, to make a story out of it in which there is no journalist. So a theater in New York asked me if I wanted to do a play for them. It just happened to be at that time. And I said, well, I've just written this thing, Betrayed. They said, let's see. And one thing led to another.
And you'd never written a play before. This just came.
I wrote a really bad one in college, which will go unmentioned.
We all
but
did.
I did have a, I kind of wanted to be, you know, like you, an actor for
a
while.
I want to be like that too.
Yeah, yeah. Well, you were and you will be. I wanted to be a stage actor, like Laurence Olivier was.
And you wrote him a letter.
My hero, I did. I said, "Dear Lord Olivier, I want to be an actor. What should I do?"
And what did he say?
And he wrote back, he actually wrote back and said, "Don't." Yeah, it's a very difficult life. And it is, and I'm glad I didn't try. But I've always loved theater. And what's great about theater for me as a writer is I'm with other people, and I'm collaborating, and we're working together, and I'm learning from the director and from the actors, and this thing is a group project. It's taking shape as we rehearse it. The story, the script is changing every day based on the rehearsals. And then,
which is far different than the solitary life of writing the essay where you go in there and get forehead stress fractures and wait for blood to come out of your eyes. And
absolutely.
You're done and alone again.
It was a lot easier in a way because sitting down with mountains of notes and recordings and printouts and then trying to turn that into something with a shape, and that's really hard.
Now, you perpetrated some bad poetry in college as well.
I did, yeah.
That covers playwriting.
Yep.
Nonfiction.
There's
poetry,
been a lot of that.
Which you can come back to at some point and re-enter.
Only in private.
All poetry
and
is
fiction.
In private. And in fiction, you have two books of fiction. First, the first one came out not long after Village of Waiting, and then the second one, the Square.
Central Square.
Central Square.
Yeah.
It's been 16 years since you brought out a work of fiction. Do you feel trapped in truth?
You know,
all this truth going on.
Mainly facts are my friends. It's reassuring for me to start with some stuff that's solid and that I've gone out and found.
You can lie from there.
That's until the fact checkers at the New Yorker get a hold of it.
Well, that's what I'm saying. Have you thought about transitioning from that basis of fact and then lying your way into something which gives you a few more options? I mean, you're trapped in the truth when you write
pieces. That's what the play Betrayed did. It was the first experience of imaginative writing since those two novels, and it was liberating. It was great to be able to invent dialogue, but I was...
Convenient, too.
Yeah, very convenient. But I was sort of reassured by starting from a position of having reported it. Mm-hmm. I knew these people. Most of the dialogue in the play came directly from... I conflated characters. I made up part of a plot, but it was good to have started out as a journalist, but then to move into creative work like that was exciting. But, you know, novels are really... They're hard. I don't take naturally to fiction. It was 10 years of going against my own grain writing those two novels.
And then we're kind of skipping over interesting times, writings from a turbulent decade.
It's a collection of New Yorker pieces, mostly, yeah.
And it's a lot of fun, if you like the darkness that possesses us as a people, but also some wonderful studies. And this unwinding ends up being kind of also a collection of ideas you've worked through for a while, and they're, you've found a way to immerse yourself in the national mood by way of finding a few characters. How did you find the characters around which you kind of built your narrative line?
Well, first let me just say that this is the closest thing to a novel I've written since I wrote those two novels. Every line of it is fact and checkable, but it had the process of creating this felt more like the invention that goes into writing fiction, because I had to find a structure for it. I had to find a voice for every character, and there's no first person, so it kind of freed me up to allow the characters a lot of license, and the prose takes on the rhythms and diction of the characters. So this was a liberating book to write for those reasons. In 2008, I had come back from Iraq and was covering the campaign that year, and it just suddenly seemed like pillars were falling down all around us. My God, I mean, the banking system, the housing system, the car manufacturers, the whole economy, plus this incredible political campaign. It felt like, you know, an epic year, like 1932 or something. And it began to seem like maybe we were at the end of something, in the beginning of a new period. It had that feeling of a big historical transformation. So I thought that's the kind of big, big subject that I like to write about. Mm-hmm. But I always, as you suggested, need to find a small way through it. Not to take, just grab it with both hands, it's too big, but to find people. Took me a couple of years to figure out how to do it, but I met this guy named Dean Price down in North Carolina. He's a truly American original, and yet kind of deeply in the American grain. He's the son of tobacco farmers. He lives in this region that is old and traditional and very red America, and it had been tobacco and textiles, but those had gone away, and it was now on hard times. And he was trying to make something of his own life and also something in his community he had been a truck stop owner. He owned these gas stations and convenience stores, and he decided to go into biodiesel, and he was going to make his fuel, his own fuel, from canola oil and from waste restaurant oil, and sell it as diesel fuel. But that only begins to give you a sense of why he's such an exciting person to listen to. He's a great talker, storyteller. I began to think, rather than write a whole pedestrian book about 30 years of American history, why not find 3, 4, 5 people from around the country, representative areas, a Rust Belt America.
Youngstown,
Ohio, Tammy Thomas. Someone from Washington, so I can get at what has happened to our government and politics during this period. It became this guy, Jeff Conaton, who was an aide to Joe Biden, and then he became a lobbyist, and then he went back to government after the financial crisis. Silicon Valley, et cetera. So it took a mixture of luck and purposefulness to find these people. Some of them, like Dean, I just stumbled upon while working on something else. Others, like Tammy Thomas in Youngstown, by that point in the process, I needed someone in the Rust Belt, and I needed a woman, and I found...
How did you find one?
You just go to the Rust Belt and say, does anyone know any women here?
That can get you arrested.
It can, yeah. Can get you kicked out of a lot of bars. I asked a few people I knew in Cleveland and in Chicago and a couple other places, you know, is there a story or a person who's sort of involved in trying to turn around a community that's part of the deindustrialization of this region? Mm-hmm. And two different people mentioned a woman named Tammy Thomas, who was a black woman from Youngstown with three kids. Her mother was a heroin addict. She had everything going against her. And what saved her was, and meanwhile, Youngstown was going against her, because from her early teens, it went into a death spiral with the end of the steel industry, which happened faster than Detroit and more dramatically in some ways than Detroit. She got a job at a GM auto parts factory, one of the last assembly line jobs left in Youngstown. And for 20 years, that allowed her to survive and to raise her kids and to protect her kids. And then that job was shipped to Mexico. And she had to reinvent herself, and she became a community organizer in Youngstown, which is what she was when I met her. So, and yet, all of that sounds like it's aligned with what I was looking for. You still can't know who this person is and whether they're going to work until you've gone out to meet them and spent time together. Do they talk? Yeah. Are they willing to let you ask a lot of prying questions and hang out? You don't just go and do a quick interview. I spent weeks with these people, driving around in her car, having her show me her childhood in Youngstown, her teenage years in Youngstown, the factory that had closed down. She was willing to do that and was a more dynamic and interesting and admirable person than I had even counted on. So I got lucky. That name came up and she turned out to be a gold mine.
You're listening to the National Writers Series from IPR News Radio. Coming up in the second half, George Packer reads from The Unwinding, An Inner History of the New America.
Listening to the National Writers Series from Interlochen Public Radio. I'm Doug Stanton, founder of the year-long book festival held in the historic City Opera House in Traverse City, Michigan. We continue now with Benjamin Bush's conversation with George Packer, whose latest book is The Unwinding, An Inner History of the New America.
So you have these very American stories from kind of very representative areas of the U.S. And then within that, you intersperse our celebrities, which in some ways dictates our popular culture's perception of itself. You know, you throw Oprah in there, which is not, you didn't go interview, but you didn't need to. She's created a story that sold itself.
You're not going to get to the real Oprah. You should
so
focus
many, I mean, Jay-Z
on
Jay-Z and a number of other people that you
Newt
put in
Gingrich,
there.
Newt Gingrich, Sam Walton, Colin Powell, Robert Rubin.
They've already said what they want you to hear.
They're not going to reveal anything, and you're going to spend a lot of time and effort trying to even get an interview. I've done this for The New Yorker. Yeah. VIP interviews are not my favorite thing. And then they'll have ground rules, and I need to see the quotes, and blah, blah, blah.
I do that.
Yeah, I know. This escalation.
I like to change my quotes afterwards.
No, you pretty soon everyone will be doing that. It's the escalation of ground rules.
The rehistory.
The bane of reporting these days. But all these people are very practiced at it. They'll have PR people sitting in on the interview. It's pointless. Rather, what I thought I should do is go and read them. Most of them had written autobiographies. You can learn a lot about someone from their autobiography, even if they didn't write it.
I had Doug Stanton write mine.
I read lots of interviews with them. I listened to a lot of Jay-Z's music. I read Sam Walton's Made in America and Colin Powell's My American Journey. And what I got was, I chose them partly for the walks of life. Newt Gingrich is a hugely important political figure. I think more than anyone shaped the toxic politics that we live with today. He kind of invented it, or at least mastered it back in the late 70s, early 80s. Oprah shaped our confessional pop culture. Mm-hmm. Sam Walton, hugely successful businessman from nowhere, from little town in Oklahoma, and then set up shop in Bentonville, Arkansas. He helped create the race to the bottom, which is much of the American economy today. Amazon, I think of as a kind of Walmart for better educated people.
And you just wrote that very important piece
on Amazon,
yeah.
So they're sort of sprinkled throughout the book as, I think of them as like these giant stone monuments on the landscape, and we have to reckon with them. You can't write about America without thinking about our celebrities. They've replaced the institutions in some ways. They've taken the place of, there was just a story in the New York Times yesterday about how instead of government-funded scientific research, we now have billionaire-funded scientific research. We have Lawrence Ellison and Bill Gates deciding what we're gonna do research on, because they have the money and government doesn't. And that's, you sort of see that across so many sectors of society. And I also wanted to have fun, so I wrote these pieces about the celebrities a bit in their voice. Mm. Like with Sam Walton, you have to get it, kind of the slightly false, folksy down-home tone. With
the Waltons.
With Oprah, you have to get something about the kind of headlong, gushing sentence structure, and everything is great and getting better and better and better, except maybe not for her audience.
And in our landscape, they sit within this landscape of disappointment generally. You know, we don't often get to fulfill these dreams that they paint for us, but there's still these beacons of hope that if somehow you are, you know, true in your desires, that eventually you'll persevere and you'll be able to have them. In fact, they'll recommend them for you.
Yeah.
And then you have a chance to, you know, chase something which is really, you know, pretty low percentage of catching.
Well, you've hit it. It's the dream. It's sort of the philosophy of positive thinking.
It's how Hollywood films emerge. You know, you wait for the Great Depression and you go hide in someone else's perfect life.
You go into the silver screen, yeah. No, and I think at times of desperation, I'm thinking, you know, of times of great gaps between wealthy and ordinary Americans. The 20s is a good example. That's kind of when modern celebrity was born, with advertising and movies, The Great Gatsby. And it's the kind of time we live in now. When the gap gets so great, people start to live through them. Mm-hmm. And even though we maintain that American idea of winning the lottery, people sort of have stopped believing it, really. And when Jay-Z, I heard him give a concert at the new arena in Brooklyn, right near where I live, while I was writing The Unwinding, and Jay-Z's in it. He talked as if his success was their success, was his audience's success. Mm-hmm. And his audience would flash the corporate logo of Jay-Z's music and clothing business as if they were kind of part of the deal.
The share owners.
Yeah, it stuck with me. Like, they identified with him and his lifestyle in a way that suggested they had stopped thinking that it was their own lives. And when we hear that, if I can do it, you can do it, we kind of know that that's not true. You don't have to do it. I'm already doing it. I'm doing it for you. Give me your ambitions and I'll do it. And that's kind of the role celebrities play today. They don't rise with the rest of the country. They rise from it. And we live through them more intensely than I think is healthy.
That's kind of an amazing quote. could we hear that again? You were heavily influenced by Orwell in your early years.
Yes.
And Orwell kind of classified his time, the 20th century, as imperialism, communism, and fascism. He's not around.
Right.
You are, and The Unwinding is kind of something I think he would have enjoyed reading. What do you think has replaced his kind of categories? Is it now the internet, and you know, how many other things do we have? What do you kind of feel define currently our problems as much as our strengths?
That's a good question. Orwell was my MFA program. I just read all of his books in my 20s. I was working in construction, and I remember during lunch breaks, I was buried deeply in Animal Farm.
I raise animals, and I'm very suspicious of them now.
Yes, you never know.
These chickens look weird.
Keep an eye on them. You might
at you sideways.
Make sure your security is good.
Goat eyes are weird looking.
Yeah. So, Orwell really, as much as anyone, gave me an idea of what a nonfiction writer could be. I didn't even know what nonfiction was. It didn't exist in my head. Did you study nonfiction in school? When I was in English, in high school English, we read novels and poetry and plays. But I read Homage to Catalonia on my way back from Africa.
We just read Ethan Frome.
Which is...
Over and over.
It's good. That's depressing.
Wasn't that bad, actually.
Yeah. Something about that bleak New England landscape, though.
Yeah, well, yeah. I was living in it.
No,
so.
Well, no wonder you've gone from upstate New York to upstate Michigan.
Yeah.
It's in your soul. Homage to Catalonia was my first exposure, like how great nonfiction could be. It's literature, too. So your question is a good one. I mean, we don't live in an age of ideologies like Orwell. We don't live in a time, and thank God, when a really powerful and terrible idea could take hold of millions of people and lead them to go off and kill millions of other people, which is what was true in his time. We have our smaller ideas. And I don't even know if they deserve the ism at the end. But I mean, we certainly...
Aren't those small ideas affecting large
movements? Well, I'm going to mention two or three. One is American exceptionalism, which...
Which is true.
Are you being Stephen Colbert?
George, why do you hate America?
Yeah, I knew that was coming. Well, it was true in people's minds, which is really all that matters, because that's where
truth is.
History is made. And in a way, Iraq is the story of what happens when some very powerful people get a very aggressive and simple idea of American exceptionalism into their heads. Mm-hmm. That's what the Assassin's Gate is about.
Right.
But I think that has really been eclipsed. Americans do not want to spread freedom around the world. We are in a period of profound retrenchment where if Obama didn't say a word about Ukraine or Syria, I don't think a lot of the country would think we're failing our mission overseas. There would be some, but not that many, because we are focused on ourselves. I think maybe the big ism that I see in a lot of areas of our culture is libertarianism. It's really powerful. You see it in the tech world, in Silicon Valley, at Amazon. You see it in the Tea Party. Mm-hmm. And it's this disbelief in authority and in institutions and in collective action. Mm. I think it's a false idea of human life. You know, we're not alone. We don't make it by ourselves. Everyone is interconnected in some way. And the idea that we're all entrepreneurs just hacking our way through the jungle of the economy by ourselves toward the mother lode, which is kind of like the libertarian fantasy out in California, it's just a false idea, but it's very powerful, especially for younger people. And it's partly like part of the disbelief and skepticism that's settled over so many Americans. Like, government is irrelevant or worse, it's negative, and so or any big traditional institution. So I think libertarianism is a pretty powerful ism in our life.
Do you think that's affecting the way we think about evidence? We seem to be having a huge part of our population is predisposed to despise evidence now. And it's almost more this strange dissonance between what we believe and what's true. Because if you believe it, isn't that as true as anything could be?
Right.
Versus
right. Everyone has their own truth.
Everyone has their own truth. Yeah. Is that part of this? Is that beginning to erode our ability to reason with
yeah.
anything other
yeah.
than you know, kind of strange, ambitious ideas?
I'll answer with an example. During the 2008 campaign, I was in Eau Claire, Wisconsin, mm-hmm. not far from here, and just trying to get a feel for how the Obama-Clinton race in the primaries was going. And I was talking to an editor at the Eau Claire Leader Telegram, the local paper. Mm-hmm. And he said to me, you know, we used to get real letters to the editor where like some crank in his living room would write, you know, you don't know what you're talking about and blah, blah, blah. And he welcomed them because like everyone had the right and it was a good thing for them to express themselves. Now he said what I get are talking points and they all read the same. As if, you know, RNC Central or DNC Central dictated them, sent out an email blast, which is probably what happened. So he saw the same language in letter after letter that came down from Fox News or from MSNBC.
Is that destroying our use of language? The way of, the repetition of language to the point where it becomes meaningless, like patriotism was destroyed by the Iraq War. You know, are we taking some of our powerful words and just using them.
Yeah, you're leading me down a dangerous road because I have, I'm a bit of a crank myself, and because I'm a bit critical of the technology world, I've become known as a curmudgeon, and I do recognize that.
Good word.
A sense of decline, which is related to the unwinding,
right.
can be. Confused with having just turned 50, and maybe it's my own decline that I'm really writing about. So I'm wary of saying everything is bad and it was better before, because I recognize that that's the way people my age sound, and it's really annoying. On the other hand, things have gotten worse. For example, newspapers. We used to have these community newspapers like the Eau Claire Leader Telegram that provided news that local people used in order to figure out what life was like for them and what the main problems were. And this editor was telling me, that's not what we do anymore. We don't have enough money for reporting. So we have columnists, and a lot of them are columnists in Washington. Mm-hmm. So we're getting this national noise instead of local news, which is actually based in facts. I saw the same thing during that same campaign year in the southeastern Ohio, in this little town called Gloucester, where I went into this diner on Main Street for breakfast, and everyone sounded like a cable news anchor. Hmm. They had all been watching.
That'd be a great scene.
It was weird. It was.
That's excellent coffee, George.
It was sort of Twin Peaks-like, I guess.
Thank you, Bob.
Remember Twin Peaks?
Back to you.
Yeah. No, it was like, well, do you think Palin's going to get a bounce out of the convention, you know, or her negative's going to be too high? It was this. It's not that there was anything wrong with talking that way. It just seemed as if people were no longer talking about their own lives. They had been taken over by cable news. And so what's replaced the idea of a kind of independent-minded and at least aspiring toward objective media is a lot of noise and opinion, which is cheap. Reporting costs money. I know, I can tell you that betrayed piece cost a lot of money.
Yeah.
Opinion is very cheap, and as the media have been hollowed out by the internet and by the loss of advertising and some of their own mistakes, they've turned to this, and I think it has made it harder for Americans to agree on a body of facts. Just as a starting point, we'll have arguments, but at least let's accept a certain reality in common.
Are we losing context? I think that's what the stories seem to be thinning out. They get to the point, like, you know, airplane missing, period. And we're kind of like, what the hell happened? And you're like, right. Wouldn't you like to know?
Yeah.
You know, tune in tomorrow and we'll say one more word. Aircraft missing, likely gone.
Well,
what does that mean? That
was sort of what the Malaysians were saying. Yeah. It was a little hard to figure that story out. In fact, we still haven't figured that story out. But, you know, there's still great journalism, and there's still a desire for it. I mean, if you read a really good newspaper or a really good magazine or watch good news or listen to good news on the radio, you can be informed. It's not impossible. It's just unlikely. Because there is so much noise.
All right. But I wanted to address one more thing, and that's the greatest task of someone who's written a masterful tome on the American soul, and now you've been asked to turn this into a screenplay, which is yet another genre off your list. We're running out.
Yeah. And it's a hard one.
Yeah. This is such a hard
400 pages is easy, but like just a little dialogue, that's really hard.
And so you're just going into that now, which is
interesting. Yeah, just starting it. It's a little adventure and experiment. I don't know if it's going to work. It seems like a producer who said, "Oh, let's turn this into a movie," is a really ambitious person, because I don't know if we've given the audience a sense of the structure, but this book covers 35 years and it does it by introducing you to a handful of these people we've been talking about, and then you leave them and meet someone else, and then you hear about Newt Gingrich, and then you come back to the first, and then you meet Oprah Winfrey, and then you... So it's this kaleidoscopic structure, and it asks a lot of readers. I think
you're pulling from that noise throughout this book. You're pulling from the advertisements, from the slogans, from all these things keep on emerging as kind of the background collage of who we are at certain periods of time. I really like the way you divided it and used kind of, you know, who we're telling each other to be and what we're telling each other to buy as kind of our back piece, you know.
You know, by taking out the first person, which I'd always used in nonfiction, what I got to do was allow the characters to talk and not have to explain it all and not have to come to a conclusion. And a lot of reviewers faulted me for that, but that was my intent. I did not want to give you a little tidy what's wrong with America and how to fix it. I wanted to plunge you into the stream of history through these stories and have you find yourself through that.
We'll eventually get you to be a pundit and you can rewrite it the way we want it, but could you read a little piece of this for us?
Sure. So this is the beginning of part two, and this is about Dean Price, the guy from North Carolina. At this point, he owns these truck stops. His business is starting to go south with the early housing bust. And he's thinking he needs to do something different, but he doesn't yet know what. A two-lane asphalt road ran past the woods, white oak, shagbark hickory, Carolina ash. And in the shadows of the trees, a tobacco barn was year by year collapsing on itself, the metal roof sloping inward, pieces of bare siding hanging loose from nails. Nearby, a white clapboard house with empty windows squatted at the roadside, half smothered in tree branches and vines, while a fire-scorched, handwritten sign on the outside wall still advertised, "Crush." Farther along, the road took a turn, and a tidy brick ranch house with a big satellite dish mounted on top stood in the golden sunlight of a red-brown field. Another bend, a gentle hill, deep woods again, then an abandoned metal warehouse alone in a clearing. The road straightened and flattened and came to a stoplight where a pair of strip malls faced each other, parking lots full, a Walgreens across from McDonald's, Shell opposing BP. Another light, a shuttered car dealership, a vast scrapyard with a mountain of twisted metal and stacked timbers, next door to a spinning mill that was being methodically gutted like a great whale and sold off one part at a time. Then downtown,
the lonely little Main Street, a Taekwondo studio, a government benefits office, a closed restaurant, a nameless corner store for rent, two pedestrians in four blocks, a Dollar General that marked the far end of town. On the other side, the country opened up at once, the road passing fields, corn planted on one, nothing on the next. And then a residential development with two-story look-alike houses in neat rows laid out across someone's former tobacco farm. And beyond the subdivision, isolated on acres of grass behind a split-rail fence and a man-made lake, the supersized faux chateau of a celebrity NASCAR driver. The landscape Dean had returned to, where he planned to live out his life, was very old and also new, as particular as anything in America, and also as generic, as beautiful and as ugly. In his imagination, it had become a nightmare, so profoundly wrong that he called it sinful, and he hated the sin more than any casual visitor or distant critic possibly could. Yet he also saw here a dream of redemption, so unlikely and glorious that it could only fill the mind's eye of a visionary native son. Once, driving through Cleveland County, Dean happened to pass the Hardshell Baptist Church that his father had once tried to get, but failed, the failure that had broken his father's will. Dean had gone down with his father to Cleveland County and heard the sermon that he had given for his audition back around 1975, so that decades later he recognized the church. And he also noticed that there was now a f***ing Bojangles right next door. For Dean, Bojangles had come to represent everything that was wrong with the way Americans lived, how they raised their food and transported it across the country, how they grew the crops to feed the animals they ate, the way they employed the people who worked in the restaurants, the way the money left the community. Everything about it was wrong. Dean's own business, gas and fast food, had become hateful to him, and he saw the error of his ways as his father never had. And the conjunction of his father's legacy and his own struck him with bitter irony as he drove past. He was seeing beyond the surfaces of the land to its hidden truths. Some nights, he sat up late on his front porch with a glass of Jack and listened to the trucks heading south on 220, carrying crates of live chickens to the slaughterhouses, always under cover of darkness, like a vast and shameful trafficking. Chickens pumped full of hormones that left them too big to walk. And he thought how these same chickens might return from their destination as pieces of meat to his floodlit Bojangles up the hill from his house. And that meat would be drowned in the bubbling fryers by employees whose hatred of the job would leak into the cooked food. And that food would be served up and eaten by customers who would grow obese and end up in the hospital in Greensboro with diabetes or heart failure, a burden to the public, and later Dean would see them riding around the Mayadan Walmart in electric carts because they were too heavy to walk the aisles of a supercenter, just like hormone-fed chickens. Thank you.
That was George Packer at the National Writers Series, talking with Benjamin Bush. Packer is the author of The Assassin's Gate, America in Iraq, and The Unwinding, An Inner History of the New America. Next time on the broadcast, Steve Luxenberg. His book, Annie's Ghosts, was on the Washington Post's Best Book List of 2009. Learn more about the National Writers Series and upcoming events at nationalwritersseries.org, and listen to past programs at interlochenpublicradio.org. For IPR, I'm Linnea Melkarek.